Ron Ritchie was to have been our MC this morning, but Ron came down with the flu this week, so I'm sure he'd appreciate your prayers for him. And Elaine and I will be leaving tomorrow morning for Dallas Theological Seminary, where we're involved with a spiritual emphasis week there throughout this next week, and we would very much appreciate your prayers for that ministry as well. Don't worry, Lord willing, I'll be back next Sunday to finish up these studies in Nehemiah. And we come to the last chapter of this great book, and we'll only take a part of it, but if you like stories with happy endings, you probably won't like chapter 13, Nehemiah. You'll probably say when we're through, well, he should have quit with chapter 12. And that great dedication and celebration of the dedication of the wall that is recorded there. Chapter 13 is really the story of a backward slide on the part of these people. Nehemiah was gone for a while. And as we go through this, I think you'll be reminded of the old proverb, when the cat's away, the mice will play. It all began on the very day on which the celebration and dedication of the wall took place, as these opening verses indicate. On that day, the book of Moses was read aloud in the hearing of the people. And there it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever be admitted into the assembly of God, because they had not met the Israelites with food and water, but had hired Balaam to call a curse down on them. Our God, however, turned the curse into a blessing. And when the people heard this law, they excluded from Israel all who were of foreign descent. Now, you may be a bit disturbed by this, because this looks like a very evident case of racial discrimination, or at least a bigotry on the part of Israel. Why should they exclude the Ammonites and the Moabites, the inhabitants of these two countries on the eastern side of the Dead Sea? We now call that land Jordan. Why should they be excluded from the assembly of Israel? You remember, back in chapter 10, we saw the Israelites, after a very solemn time of rededication of their lives, they took a vow that they would not intermarry with the members of these other races, and thus they would obey the commands of the law of God. And that vow, according to chapter 10, was they bound themselves with a curse and an oath to obey these commandments. And yet here already, some perhaps 10 years later, that covenant has already been broken, and many Ammonites and Moabites are found in the congregation of Israel, and they got there by Israelite men marrying the daughters of Ammonite and Moabite families, something which God had strictly forbidden in the law of Moses. If you want to look that up, you can read it yourself in Deuteronomy chapter 23. Well, I know some of you must be saying, well, what's wrong with Ammonites and Moabites? These days, we live in a day when nobody can stand to be excluded from anything. Women want to join men's clubs. Mexicans want to enter the United States without any restrictions whatsoever. Homosexuals want marriage rights and are demanding those today. People resent private beaches or private parks or private anything. And if this happened today, you can almost be sure there would be demonstrations in front of the walls of Jerusalem and people bearing placards that would say, Ammonites and Moabites demand equal rights, because this is the spirit of the times in which we live. But as always in the scriptures, there was a good reason for what God was doing here. It may sound a bit strange to us, because it was the reason is given here in verse 2. It was because when the Israelites left Egypt, they came into the edge of the promised land and into the country of the Ammonites, and they were not met by these people and offered normal desert hospitality of food and water for their needs. But instead, the Moabites and the Ammonites hired a prophet named Balaam to curse the people of Israel. There's an interesting story in connection with that. I won't take time to read it or even recount it for you, but many of you will remember that Balaam is forever famous because as he was trying to ride his donkey up to the hilltop to curse the people, as he was hired to do, the donkey saw an angel of the Lord standing in the pathway, and the donkey would not go past the angel. And the prophet kept beating his donkey three different times until finally God gave the donkey a voice, and he spoke out and rebuked his master and said, "Why are you beating me?" And then the Lord opened the prophet's eyes, and he too saw the angel of the Lord. Now, it's a humiliating thing to be rebuked by a donkey. And this is a great lesson to remember. There are oftentimes hidden reasons why God is acting, and we need to be very careful that we do not violate those reasons. Well, what was wrong? You see, it was 9 centuries before these events in Nehemiah that Israel was mistreated by the Ammonites and the Moabites. And some of you, I'm sure, must be saying, how long does God stay mad anyhow? 900 years is a very long time. And I think for this reason, many people, many critics reading these Old Testament stories misrepresent the God of Israel as being vindictive and easily angered and overreacting to situations of this type and cursing people for no real good reason at all, and allowing them to remain under that curse century after century after century. And this offends our sense of justice. And perhaps some of you have, in reading this story, would feel the same way. But actually, the attempt of the Ammonites and the Moabites to curse Israel reveals something about their hearts. And what we often forget about God is that he's reading the hearts of men and women. He sees what's going on in our inner lives, in our motives, in our attitudes. And he's dealing with that. We see only the surface. And we therefore often misjudge what God is doing because we think he's being unfair. But he's reacting to something that's much deeper. And if we check this story out a bit, we can see some of the reasons that God saw for this long enduring curse. Back, for instance, in the little book of Ezra, which precedes Nehemiah, you needn't turn to it if you don't want to, but in chapter 9 of Ezra, there's an account of a similar situation that arose 30 years earlier than Nehemiah's day, when Ezra had led a group back from Babylon to Jerusalem. And he too discovered that the people were intermarrying with these neighboring tribes contrary to the law of Moses. And we read that in the opening verses of chapter 9 of Ezra. He says, "After these things had been done, the leaders came to me and said, 'The people of Israel, including the priests and the Levites, have not kept themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices, like those of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, Egyptians, and Amorites. They have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, and have mingled the holy race with the people around them, and the leaders and the officials have led the way in this unfaithfulness. Now that was a cause of great distress to Ezra. If you read the whole account, you'll see that he was actually appalled into silence over this terrible violation. And in the midst of his prayer that follows this, he adds these words from verse 10 on. But now, O our God, what can we say after this? For we have disregarded the command you gave through your servants the prophets when you said the land you are entering to possess is a land polluted by the corruption of its peoples. By their detestable practices, they have filled it with their impurity from one end to another. Therefore, do not give your daughters in marriage to their sons, or take their daughters for your sons. Do not further their welfare or prosperity at any time, that you may be strong and eat the good things of the land and leave it to your children as an everlasting inheritance. Now we can see from that that there was some reason why God forbade this social intercourse with the Ammonites and the Moabites. Their practices were terribly degrading. And if they were allowed to intermarry with Israelites, they would interject into the life of Israel some of these customs. But actually, there's even more to it than this. What we must never forget in reading these Old Testament stories is that God is teaching His people, both in Israel and in the church today, some very vital lessons with a kind of visual aid. These stories are indicating something going on inside. And not only inside the Israelites, but inside the church as well. Remember, Paul tells us that all these things happen to Israel as examples for us, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So there's a picture here of something happening with us. Well, now, what is it? Well, if you trace these two tribes, Ammonites and Moabites, back to their beginnings, you discover that they are relatives of Israel. They were the sons, Ammon and Moab, the founders of these countries, were the sons of Lot, the nephew of Abraham. And you have the story in connection with the destruction of the city of Sodom and, cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. You remember as the brimstone and the fire was raining down to destroy these wicked cities, that angels led Lot and his family out of the cities up into the mountainside. And Lot's wife looked back and was turned to a pillar of salt, but Lot and his two daughters hid in a cave in the mountain while the cities burned around them. And there is a rather sordid tale of how these girls, evidently feeling they were the last two women left on earth, contrived to trick their father into laying with them sexually, and they both conceived and bore sons, and one of them was named Ammon, and the other was named Moab. And they went on to found a tribe and a country by the same name. Now what that means is that Ammon and Moab are relatives of Israel, and yet enemies, eternal enemies of these people. And it's a picture for us of something that's going on in our lives. Do you ever have relatives like that, that you'd love to get rid of, but you can't because they belong to you, and yet they're troublesome and obnoxious and hard to live with? And yet there's nothing you can do about them because they're relatives. Well, that's the way Ammon and Moab were. They were constantly harassing Israel. They were constantly trying to undermine them and to destroy them and corrupt them and pollute them. But Israel was forbidden to wipe them out because they belonged to them. Now, in the New Testament, we learn that we have an enemy like that. You know what it's called? It's called the flesh. The old nature, the Adamic nature that we inherited when we were born because we're children of Adam. That inner commitment to self-centeredness that afflicts us all. We're all born with this, aren't we? I looked in the mirror this morning and I saw my greatest problem. It's me. Or, sorry, grammarians, it is I. And this is true of all of us, isn't it? You see, there's something about us that wants to be king, wants to be lord, wants to be served, wants to be ministered to, wants to regulate everything, wants to run the world with us at the center of things. And that's the flesh, it's called, in the New Testament. And we'd love to get rid of it sometimes, because it tricks us and traps us and destroys us and corrupts us, and we sense it at times. We see how miserable it can make us and lead us into terrible actions that we repent of later. And sometimes, I know I felt this way, I'm sure you have too, you'd like to get inside and rip that thing out and take it away and get rid of it forever. But you can't, because it's related to you, you see. And yet we're called to live above it, in the midst of the struggle of it, and to overcome it, and to walk with God nevertheless. And that's the struggle of the Christian life. Now, all this is beautifully represented here to us in these stories. In verses 4 to 9, we get a picture of, in detail, of how this came about. Nehemiah tells us, before this, Eliashib, the priest, really the high priest, had been put in charge of the storerooms of the house of our God. He was closely associated with Tobiah. You'll recall Tobiah, the Ammonite, was one of the enemies that opposed the rebuilding of the wall and gave Nehemiah a bad time all during his early ministry here. And Eliashib, the high priest, was associated with him. And he had provided him with a large room formerly used to store the grain offerings and incense and temple articles, and also the tithes of grain, new wine, and oil prescribed for the Levites, singers, and the gatekeepers, as well as the contributions for the priests. But while all this was going on, Nehemiah says, I was not in Jerusalem. For in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Sometime later, I asked his permission and came back to Jerusalem, and here I learned about the evil thing Eliashib had done in providing Tobiah a room in the courts of the house of God. I was greatly displeased and threw all Tobiah's household goods out of the room. I gave orders to purify the room, and then I put back into them the equipment of the house of God with the grain offerings and the incense. Now, here's a terribly involved bit of political intrigue that sounds very much like what goes on in Washington, D.C., doesn't it? You see, the high priest's grandson, we learn in later in this chapter, had married the daughter of Sanballat, the governor of Samaria, who was an ally of Tobiah the Ammonite. Both of these were vitriolic and bitter enemies of Nehemiah. And the high priest had allowed his grandson to marry this Ammonite into this Ammonite family. Now, this cozy alliance had led to an invitation to Tobiah to actually move into the temple itself. And to make room for him, he took over the storeroom that was set apart for the grain and the oil and the incense used by the Levites in their purification and their ritual ceremony. So there were two wrongs involved. An Ammonite and his family were actually living in the temple of God, contrary to the law of Moses. And second, in order to allow that, they had deliberately defrauded the Levites of their own rights of story. Now, when Nehemiah returns, he goes into prompt and passionate action. He threw the baggage out, and he fumigated the rooms, and he replaced them, the oil and the grain and the incense, into its proper place. Now, I think a lot of people feel that Nehemiah overreacted to this. We're so trained today to not get upset by the presence of evil that we think it's strange that a man should act like Nehemiah did. We've lost to a great degree our ability to express outrage and public indignation over things that are wrong. And you can see how little of that is expressed if you read the letters to the papers and so on, where the public has an opportunity to speak out. But Nehemiah apparently loses his temper, behaves disgracefully, and throws the people out physically with great violence. Now, I think we need to remember, however, an incident in the New Testament. When Jesus came into the temple, and he found it filled with money changers who were making a large income off the sale of the sacrifices and the offerings required in the temple. And it was a sordid scene of the commercializing of the worship of Israel. And Jesus reacted very similar to Nehemiah, didn't he? Remember, he took a whip. He made a whip. And with that, he went slashing and flashing around that temple and upset the tables and drove them out, much to the distress of many pacifists ever since. And it indicates that there is a time for drastic action. There is a time for strong stands against evil, which others have indifferently accepted. You see, the problem is, this is the way evil works. It invades us almost quietly. Before we're aware of it, people have compromised largely and gone along with standards widely accepted. And before we know it, we find the people of God have been corrupted and polluted by this kind of thing. Many, many instances of that today. And all of it, you see, when it comes down to an individual basis, is a picture of our own individual struggle with our own flesh. And what this lesson is saying is there are times when we must take a strong stand against that sort of thing. We must be prepared to be drastic and take often painful action to clear up in our own lives things that are wrong. I think this is certainly true today, where sometimes people have allowed themselves to accept attitudes toward divorce or toward pornography or toward the use of drugs or alcohol and rather shrug their shoulders at it and allow it to take root in their own lives, many Christians. And this is a picture of how these false forces can invade our lives and take rooms in the very temple of our spirit and destroy and pollute the attitudes of our life. Remember what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount? If your right hand offends you, cut it off, he said. If your right eye offends you, pluck it out. Why? Well, take action, he says. Don't allow these things to take root in your life. And if it takes some kind of painful effort to do so, if you've allowed your heart to be involved with something that's so wrong that it's painful to give it up, you must give it up. That's what he's saying. And bear the pain and stand firm. And this is what this great story teaches us. Now, Nehemiah went still further, as verses 10 to 12 record for us. He says, I also learned that the portions assigned to the Levites had not been given to them, and that all the Levites and singers responsible for the service had gone back to their own fields. So I rebuked the officials and asked them, why is the house of God neglected? And then I called them together and stationed them at their posts, and all Judah brought the tithes of grain, new wine, and oil into the storerooms. Here's a result, you see, of the kind practice of intermarrying with Ammonites and Moabites that had been brought about by this incident that Nehemiah records here. When Tobiah moved into the temple and had to throw out the grain and the oil and the incense that the Levites needed, it meant that the Levites had no supplies to work with. Since they could not perform their ministry, they couldn't even be adequately supported. And so they went to work in the fields to earn a living for themselves, understandably. And as a result, the services of the temple were sorely neglected. If you read the last book of the Old Testament, written by the Italian prophet Malachi, you'll find that he inveighs against this same thing, remember? He calls the people to be aware of the fact that the temple was being neglected. The center of their life as a nation was not being fed. It's similar to an individual who allows his Bible reading and his prayer time to disappear from his life, who neglects these things. And soon he begins to pick up and live like the world around, and all these false forces begin to creep in and to take over and to change things. And what it calls for, you see, is drastic, deliberate action to change the whole picture. And this is what Nehemiah does. He rebuked the officials, we're told, insistent on obeying the scripture. He calls them to account. And then he calls on the people to bring in the tithes and the oil and the incense again, and to refill the temple and allow the Levites to go back to work. And thus God's order was restored in the nation. Now there's still a third step here that's very interesting in verses 13 through 14. He says, I put Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, and a Levite named Pedaiah in charge of the storerooms, and made Hanan, son of Zachar, the son of Mattaniah, their assistant, because these men were considered trustworthy. They were made responsible for distributing the supplies to their brothers. And in a characteristic prayer, he adds, remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services. Notice that this is a representative group that he chooses. There's a priest, there's a scribe, there's a Levite, and there's a layman, honored and respected, and all four of these, chosen to represent various aspects of the life of Israel, share one great quality together. And the important thing, of course, is the quality that he looked for. He tells us, these men were considered trustworthy. That is, they were faithful men. You know, I've discovered that even in the church today, that's a quality not very highly admired. We pay lip service also often to it, but it's it's disheartening to me at times to see how few people take seriously a responsibility that they have undertaken to fulfill it faithfully, to carry it through. It's the quality that God admires. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 4 that ministers and those who minister in the church are stewards of the are servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God, and it's required of a steward that a man be found faithful. That's the primary thing God looks for. The ability to hang in with an assignment until you're through. The willingness to fulfill a responsibility year after year after year. And not need to be praised or thanked or publicly encouraged in order to do so. But it's unto the Lord to do this. To show up on time and to don't leave till the work's done and not quit before it's over. I find that's a quality that's often missing in people today, especially sometimes in men leaders. I don't know if you know it, but our former associate pastor here, David Roper, is coming out soon with a wonderful book written just for men. When it's published, I hope every man in this congregation will get a copy of it because it's rich and it has a great title, Men Made of Mud. And I want to share with you David's opening words. These are what he says. Most of my friends here in Idaho consider themselves real men. They're outdoorsmen and sportsmen. They hunt and fish. They hang their snowmobiles upside down under the snow cornices on West Mountain. They hie themselves across the desert in 4x4s at what I consider terminal velocities. I have one friend who pulled a grizzly off his wife with his bare hands. I saw another ride a log straight down a canyon wall. He almost broke the sound barrier on the way down and did break two ribs at the bottom. But to hear him tell it, it was the thrill of a lifetime. Yet for all our macho, I think we're mostly uneasy about our manhood. No one seems to know for sure what it means. We have to be told real men don't eat quiche. They never bunt. They don't have meaningful dialogues. And rarely do they think about the meaning of life. Real men, he says, love John Wayne, Monday Night Football, chainsaws, and Coors. Pete Rose, he says, is a real man. And according to Time magazine, so is Maggie Thatcher. Well, I'm afraid he sort of rung the bell on that one, that he's described what a great many men think is manhood. But not Nehemiah. When he's looking for someone, he doesn't look for somebody that's macho or has a great personality necessarily. He looks for somebody that's faithful. And God honors that. And finally, the words that will reward those who serve God acceptably in this life are these: well done, thou good and faithful servant. I've learned through the years to look for four qualities in leaders, whether it be men or women. Let me share them with you. I look first for a searching mind, a person who's mentally alert, a person who has curiosity about life, who wants to learn all the time, never gives up, always reading, always listening, always thinking about what he hears or what she hears, and trying to reason things behind it. A searching mind that has an innate curiosity, that is aware of its lack of knowledge and keeps hoping to remedy the problem and learn more all the time. That's the first thing I look for. Then second, with it, I look for a humble heart. Someone whose ego is not on the line all the time, who has to be praised and honored and patted on the back and encouraged in order to get them to do anything at all, who get disgruntled and upset and turned off if they don't get recognized. But somebody who understands that service is a privilege, that power is not conferred upon you by an office, but by serving people, becoming a servant to others is a means of awakening a sense of gratitude on their part that make them willing to follow what you suggest. And people who learn how to lead that way are always tremendously useful people in God's work and in God's kingdom. Jesus himself taught us that. He who would be greatest among you, he said, let him become the servant of all. So a humble heart is a very necessary qualification. Third, I look for an evident gift. God's people are gifted people. There isn't one of the members of the body of Christ who hasn't been equipped by the Holy Spirit by a special ability to do something. And when they know what it is, they always discover they enjoy doing it. It's their delight. It isn't a burden any more than wings are a burden to a bird. It's a delight to them. They enjoy doing those things. And I look for people who have the gift for what we're asking them to do, because they'll stay with it and enjoy it to the end. And then fourth, and undermining all the others and making them possible, is a faithful spirit. Someone who won't quit, who sees this as a ministry of service to the Lord himself, who has undertaken it out of gratitude in their own life and heart, and no matter how tough it gets and how rough it gets, they won't quit. That's what Nehemiah found. And isn't it marvelous as we go through this account how beautifully each of these qualities is seen in Nehemiah himself? What a great administrative gift he had. How he could organize things and put people to work and outline the way to go about things and help people to understand what they had to do. And it's manifest all the way through. And yet how faithful he was in this. Of all the people who observed the terrible ruin of Jerusalem, who knew about its walls broken down and its gates burned, it took a man way off in the kingdom of Persia to come and do something about it. And at great personal cost and at much expenditure of labor and of commitment, he came and he undertook the project and carried it through, and he never quit. And when the enemies gathered against him, that didn't slow him down. He stayed with it, and he encouraged others, and he pressed on till the job was accomplished. And that's the lesson of this book, isn't it? Is that God looks for these kind of people to change the age in which they live. And that's what we're called to do today. And we're all involved in it. It isn't just the obvious visible leaders who are doing this. Someone was just in the couples class this morning commenting on the fact that the work of the ministry is going on all the time around here by people out at their work and in their shops and in their homes and in their offices. And that's where it's being carried on. And what's required, you see, are faithful men and women who are willing to carry this through. Now, let's remember that when we read this prayer of Nehemiah's in verse 14. He repeats it twice more in this chapter before the end. And many times, I think people reading this think it sounds like he's self-serving, that he's concerned that God's going to forget him and not reward him adequately, and he's praying that God would not blot out what I have faithfully done, and he's looking at himself and praising himself more or less because of that. But that's the wrong way to read this prayer. You see, what he's doing is actually recognizing his own frailty and his own awareness of self-deception. He's saying, in effect, Lord, I've done all this, but you may see it differently than I. You may see something in me that would cause you to blot this all out of your book. And Lord, if you feel that way, show it to me. That's what he's asking. It's really the same prayer that David prayed at the end of Psalm 139. You remember that great prayer? Everybody loves Psalm 139. It's the great psalm about how we are fearfully and wonderfully made, how well God knows us, our downsitting and our uprising, how if we take the wings of the morning and travel to the uttermost parts of the earth, still God is there, how he watches over us, how he guards us and keeps us and knows our thoughts and everything. And then it ends with this wonderful prayer. It's well known and often quoted. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, and know my thoughts, and see if there's any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. That's a wonderfully honest prayer, isn't it? It's saying, Lord, I don't know myself very well. I deceive myself very easily. I think I'm doing fine when you may see a lot of things that are terribly wrong with what I'm doing. And so, Lord, search me and know me and see if there's any wicked way in me and lead me to the point where I can see that too. That's what he's asking. And that's what Nehemiah is praying here. Remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out what I have faithfully done for the house of my God and its services. And I think this is a great prayer for each of us to pray as we come to the conclusion of this service this morning. See, God has placed us in a critical moment of human history. All the great leaders of the past, their voices are silent as far as this generation is concerned. These drug addicts, these young yuppies who are trying to make it in the ladder of success and trying to satisfy themselves by material gain and material things. These hundreds of thousands of bankrupt, spiritually bankrupt people all around us. Who's going to talk to them? Who's going to reach them? They don't come to church, but God has placed us there and called us to this ministry to reach out to them. And we need his help in doing so. Therefore, this is a call for leadership and faithful leadership that'll stay with the task and see that it gets done, whether it be within the confines of the church ministry itself or whether it be touching the world around us. This is what God calls us to. So as we bring this to a conclusion this morning, we're going to join in singing a new little chorus that Glenn and Stephanie Waldrop will teach us. And I hope it will remind us that we are called unto to be faithful to the ministry and the gifts that God has given to us as well.